Sebastian and Alvaro and Rob for organizing this. I'll mostly be talking about work which you can find in this preprint, archive preprint here, but also probably talk about some work with some of my co-authors, which we hope to put in the archive soon. I'll leave most of the references for people, you know, most of the references you can find in the article, but I'll just mention that these two are relatively important, so I'll put those down there. So it's a talk by David Poulin about a year and a half ago at KITP, and a very early, I think largely unnoticed work by Blanchard and Jadzik from 1993. I'll just mention those. Can I just get a sense of the audience? How many people are familiar with like a Lindblad equation and open a little bit about open quantum systems? Okay. And how many people are like familiar with the ADM formula, like general relativity and constraint equation? And how many both put their hands up twice? Okay, good. There's like there's a non-zero, a three-person intersection. You with it? Yeah. Good. Okay. So. As a result, because the intersection is only three people, I'll go relatively slowly and just, well, most importantly, just ask lots of questions because there's a jargon that I might slip into or things I might forget, but also just, I can go at any pace, so ask lots of questions as we go along. Good. So let me start by, so I'll start by just posing the question, I guess, must we quantize gravity, or should we? I'm not sure which question. Let's just say, must we quantize gravity? And it'll turn out that there's a kind of a split in the community that I think people that are from the quantum gravity community have, and there's a number of no-go theorems which tell you that you have to quantize gravity. But I think people that study quantum information theory will recognize fairly quickly that that's not the case. And that's kind of, I think this, you know, there's a literature there on dynamics which couple quantum systems and classical systems, and I'll just review that, so that'll be the second thing I'll do. CQ dynamics. And once I, hopefully if I can convince you that you can have a sensible classical quantum dynamics, I'll then go on to a particular, I'll show you that you can develop a particular form of that, which I call non-commuting Hamiltonian dynamics. And then we'll get to GR. And in particular, constrained systems. So GR and constrained systems. So to start, I would say two very standard no-go, you can call them no-go theorems or maybe thought experiments that people usually use to justify why we have to quantize gravity. So I'll go over those two thought experiments. If anyone wants to add in any more reasons why we have to quantize gravity, then we can address those, but I'll mention the two big ones. So the first one is a thought experiment, which I think is originally due to Bohr in the debate over whether we should quantize electromagnetism. It kind of appears in some remarks by Feynman, and there are various versions of this no-go theorem, or thought experiment. And the thought experiment, I guess, the easiest way is like this. We can imagine a double slit experiment, and we're going to look at the interference pattern of an electron, which is either going to take a left top path or the bottom path. And we can it's going to interact both with the electromagnetic field and the gravitational field. And as you probably know, after it's gone through the slit, we expect it to be in some, say, superposition of, say, taking the top slit and then the electromagnetic field. I'm going to just write it as a state, say the electromagnetic field. Let's write like this. There'll be one state of the electromagnetic field. For example, the electron could emit some Bremsstrahlung photon, some photons through the Bremsstrahlung process. And if it takes the bottom slit, then the electromagnetic field will be in a different distinct state. And so if I'm someone sitting over here, or I have many detectors throughout space, I can measure the electromagnetic field and use it to try and determine which slit the electron went through. And it will be in a different state depending on which slit the particle went through. And so you can ask, can I learn which slit it went through by measuring everywhere the electromagnetic field in principle? And because the electromagnetic field is quantum, so even though these are distinct states, because the electromagnetic field is quantum, I cannot measure with certainty which slit the electron went through. Right? So these two states are different depending on which slit it went through, but they're not orthogonal. They have some overlap. And so the electron's interaction with the electromagnetic field will result in some sort of decoherence a little bit, but it doesn't necessarily lead to a destruction of the interference pattern because I can't tell with certainty which slit the electron went through. Is that thought experiment clear to everyone? So what's crucial here is that the electromagnetic field is quantum, and it's a quantum state which has the peculiar property that you can have two states which are different, but you can't tell them apart. They're not orthogonal. And so the argument goes that if we have a classical gravitational field, since the electron will also interact with the gravitational field, if we have a gravitational field, then if the gravitational field is classical, then I'll be able to perform measurements to determine which slit the particle went through. Because for a classical field, there's no such thing as having a classical field or a classical variable which is distinct depending on which slit the particle went through, but which is, there's no concept of non-orthogonality for a classical field. If the classical field is different depending on which slit the particle went to, then I'll be able to measure with arbitrary accuracy the classical field because there's no limit how well I could measure a classical field, and I'll be able to determine which slit the particle went through, and therefore there cannot be any interference experiment. Are people familiar with that argument? Feynman, maybe? Yeah?
Do you distinguish between the Coulomb part versus the radiative part of the electromagnetic field?
In the electromagnetic case, you mean?
In either case, yeah.
I'm not sure. Is there a significance to that here? I mean, if I want to view one as the constraint, then...
Yeah. One of them's like determined by the electron and the other one's not.
Right. That's right. So I guess I would be thinking of usually I would think that what's going to happen here is just is the radiative part. It's just the soft Bremsstrahlung that this thing is emitting that is probably causing most of the decoherence.
Okay,
for the purpose of this, I don't think there's, I guess when you get into the constraint equations of GR, that those considerations might be important. But for here, it's just a question of, can I measure the field to determine which slit part of it?
Is it clear why these are not orthogonal? I mean, it seems like I could consider situations where they were nearly orthogonal. Like,
that's right. So
emitting a particle was of order one, and probably the
yeah. So in a crappy, if someone was doing a very bad experiment, and maybe these slits were very far apart, and the you know, they were doing it too fast or too slow or whatever, then you would destroy the interference pattern. Because essentially, it just means that the electromagnetic field, you could determine which slit it went through, and you, I mean, that's decoherence effectively. So I could, you know, in fact, I could trace out the electromagnetic field here to look at the density matrix of the electron, and I will either, if these two states are very close, then I'll have I'll have off-diagonal elements of the particle in terms of which slit did it go through. And if they're very more orthogonal, the off-diagonal elements will decay depending on how orthogonal these two slits. So that's one of the arguments why we should quantize the gravitational field.
Did anyone actually make this argument? This is why we need... It doesn't seem very convincing, so I'm just... I mean, you might analyze this case, but then someone will go farther and say, therefore we need to quantize the electron.
Yeah, there's quite a few.
Therefore,
so
we need to quantize the gravitation.
Yeah, so there are various forms of this argument. This is Bohr's argument to some extent for quantizing the electromagnetic field. Feynman didn't say it like this, so Feynman just said, well, if I can have a coherent superposition of two different gravitational states, then the gravitational field should be coherent. So he just said it like that without really saying why, but this is, I think, the reason why you would say that. There's a number of famous no-go theorems which effectively amount to this argument. The general way of saying it sometimes is that the gravitational field will inherit the quantumness, needs to inherit the quantumness of the quantum, the source of the gravitational field.
But isn't this argument already a very specific coupling between gravity and quantum theory's presupposed?
Exactly.
That what gravitates are individual parts and not some mixture or some expectations.
So we'll get to the expectation value argument so that'll be the second reason that people give for quantizing the gravitational field. I'll get into that separately. But I agree that there is an implicit assumption, which is that, you know, effectively that I would call it determinism. So I'm assuming that the coupling is deterministic, that if it goes through one slit, it'll have a particular gravitational field versus if it goes to another slit, it'll have a different gravitational field. So that I would call deterministic. And you can see right away that if the coupling is not deterministic, so if there's a stochastic coupling between the particle and the gravitational field, or if there's noise, so if I imagine that it's a classical gravitational field, but there is a probability distribution over different possible gravitational fields, then measuring the gravitational field, if we have LIGO set up here, then measuring the gravitational field does not uniquely determine which slit it went through. So kind of the way out of this argument is to note that you can, if you have a stochastic coupling, and I think about mixtures of classical gravitational fields, then the argument doesn't go through. So if for example, there's noise, the coupling introduces some noise, then measuring the gravitational field is not going to uniquely determine which slit this particle.
But it would destroy the interference pattern if there is noise.
No. Why? I can imagine noise, like completely random noise, where it just arbitrarily just affects the gravitational field, that will have no effect on whether it's coherent or not. if there, if the coupling to the gravitational field has a little bit of distinguishability between these paths, then there'll be a little bit of decoherence. So the amount of decoherence has to do with how well the coupling distinguishes these two paths, but the stochasticity in some sense doesn't affect. The more stochasticity you have, the more coherence you have. Because take the extreme case where it just gives you the maximally mixed state regardless of which path it went through, then measuring the gravitational field cannot determine which path the electron took, and so cannot decohere the...
Actually, now I have a question. The top path and the bottom path are distinguishable states.
Distinguishable states of what? Of
are they orthogonal in the first system?
So they're not, they're, you mean the field or not?
The T and B, are they orthogonal?
Yeah, if you were to put a detector here, you could measure which one.
It's written, the two terms cannot interfere because T and B are orthogonal to one another.
Yes. I just mean, now imagine you trace out this degree of freedom here, the field degree of freedom. And will you, the question you can ask is, will I have a density matrix that looks like, you know, so if this is the electron, will I have a density matrix? How big will these off-diagonal elements be? And they, you know, will be related to the squared. They'll roughly be related to the overlap of the, of this. So if these two states are the same, then you have I guess actually it's not so it's something like that. So how orthogonal the field is will affect how big the coherence I can have.
Is this argument valid in any space-time dimension?
Sorry?
Is this argument valid in any space-time dimension?
Yes. I mean, I haven't made any reference to space-time. It's a very general argument.
So in particular, in three dimensions, you expect it to hold this one?
Yeah, this is very general. So it's just about if I have an interaction between two things, one of which is quantum, and it's a deterministic coupling, then you can ask, you know, can I maintain coherence of the quantum system? So the first thing to note, the only thing to note from this is that this argument, and there's a number of Nogo theorems and a huge back and forth, this argument presupposes a deterministic interaction, and so we're going to modify quantum mechanics in a crucial way, which is that it's going to be stochastic, and because it's stochastic, it evades this Nogo thought experiment and various Nogo theorems which are based on it. Are there any more questions about that one?
Yeah, so in three dimensions, gravity is meant to be the same as Chern-Simons theory.
Yes.
Chern-Simons theory would be quantized. This is a gauge theory.
Yes, okay.
So what goes wrong?
No, I'm not saying, so this is not an argument about this is why, this is the must versus should. I guess I would just say, all this argument says is that you're not required, at least this, you're not required to quantize the gravitational field.
But you just use the same argument to say that you do have to quantize gauge field.
If you have a deterministic theory, then you do have to quantize it, because otherwise you won't be able to maintain coherence. So for electromagnetism, for example, where the coupling is deterministic, and that would be the same for for Chern-Simons, or presumably, I could imagine one where I would quantize it. I mean, in the case of 2+1, there's no local degrees of freedom, so I don't know if in that case the gravitational field would know which slit it went through because it's not a local field theory. But putting that aside, this is not an argument about why we should not quantize it. Sorry. This is just an argument which says that there is wiggle room, that the argument for why we must quantize gravity is not correct. There is a loophole in the Nogo theorem, and that loophole is that if the coupling is stochastic, you can have a coupling between classical degrees of freedom and quantum degrees of freedom as long as the coupling is stochastic. That's all I'm, that's the only claim I make. Yes?
So I'm not sure of this, but it seems like the argument might be even weaker than you said. I mean, it might, it's not, just I don't see how to make a strict deduction that even if you allow a deterministic coupling, that you would destroy the interference. Because when you write this down, you're still assuming it's a quantum framework, right? I mean, you
yeah.
So I don't know, but an example I'm thinking, it's not the perfect analogy, is the Bohmian theory, where the particle does have a precise trajectory. And nevertheless, you still get, you know, you can say in any given case which slit the particle went through, and nevertheless there's interference. So I don't know how much, there might be more wiggle room even than what you're indicating here.
There may be, and I would be happy if there were. I think the main thing is that, you know, so it is true that you might not need a stochastic coupling. It may just be that you should not be able to distinguish these two states of the field, which...
Well, maybe you can distinguish. Oh, you mean experimentally distinguish?
Well, in practice. And I don't mean in practice, but just in principle, could you?
Something that will prevent you from experimenting.
Right, exactly. Yes. Okay. Yes?
In fact, maybe, I mean, I think originally the argument was not really this one, it was about stability of matter, right? Interaction light, matter, you have an electron orbiting, at some point it's going to transit, it's going to emit light. So if you assume that light is classical and for a determinate path, then you have a puzzle to resolve. I think that's essentially why, you know,
with
exotical magnetism. It goes back to stability of matter.
Well, yeah, so the ultraviolet catastrophe or something like that.
The photoelectric effect.
Yes,
that's
right.
And the same thing applies to gravity.
Well, so...
I mean, the time scale is different.
Well, that, crucially.
But it's exactly the same thing.
Okay, so we...
Stability of matter requires...
Well, we...
So usually, if you let go of that, then you let go of that. Stability of matter.
Right. I don't think here we so the ultraviolet catastrophe is something one should worry about in this theory, but the time scales are very different. So I will maybe get to that at the end in terms of so in an inflationary scenario you will get a difference if you have a quantum versus a classical gravitational field because of the ultraviolet catastrophe. That's a separate thing. So you don't have the same thing where we're putting, you know. The universe is, such a thing will happen if we put the universe at a specific temperature. Right, then you have a difference in phase space between quantum field.
I think there's something more, even if I'm saying if you resolve, suppose you don't have, so you resolve the ultraviolet catastrophe, which means there's energy there. Right? And then light interacts with matter. This is where it started, this was born, you know.
Yes.
This is what they worry about.
Yes.
Stability of the matter.
Yes.
You know, we have to stabilize the orbits.
Yes.
And we have interactions happening.
Yes.
And then, of course, when is this photon emitting? So, at some point, I mean, this is nice, but there's something. I'm saying this other example is kind of more fundamental. This happens all the time.
Well, so if you go through the history of why people were trying to quantize the electromagnetic field, that's certainly, you know, stability of the atom is something that went into it. If you now ask what's the analogous thing gravitationally, I am unaware of any kind of analogous argument of why I need to quantize gravity.
This was the first argument by the Russian guy. It was exactly the same one.
The Russian guy.
He invented the computer, quantum
gravity.
So it was. It's in the first paper. It's in the first paper. It's the same argument.
The first paper of what?
Quantum gravity. Mm. It's the same argument. You have a charge orbiting. It's emitting waves.
Right.
Anyway, it's exactly the scale is different. The numbers are different. The argument was.
Yeah. So if you so I think the analogous. We can get to that at the end when we, but there's an, so there is, in an inflationary scenario, there will be a difference. I think what you're talking about there is there'll be a difference in terms of emitting gravity waves, right? So where the phase space is for emitting gravity waves. So this is the equivalent of the stability of the atom. So during inflation, one expects in this theory to have more gravity waves produced, but that only happens during inflation. Once you exit inflation, then one doesn't have that. So.
Okay. I'm saying if you have an electron orbiting
around,
there's no electrons.
It emits gravity.
Yes.
It's classical. It emits gravity.
But it takes a very long time.
The question is whether it's fundamental or.
Yeah. But I would question that statement at all. I mean, Kantian hasn't showed us what his theories. Presumably, if the quantum system has a lowest energy state, it can't emit classical or quantum gravitational waves.
That's right.
Otherwise, this theory doesn't make sense at some more basic level. But it's nothing to do with this.
Where
it's nothing to do with the stability matter because. I mean,
if it does
have a lower energy state, then it can
emit
quantum mechanically as well. So,
yeah. Let's at least get to the. So I will mention. Let me go through one more argument. I'll show the theory, and I'm happy to discuss kind of the stability of the thing. But you'll see. I think you'll see that it is stable. So. Okay. Second argument is, which you hear often, is due to, let's write Einstein's equations. So a common thing people do, both if they just want to study the semi-classical limit of quantum gravity, or if they posit that maybe there is a classical theory, or we want to have consistency between in this equation. So the left-hand side is the gravitational degrees of freedom. It's usually treated classically. Here we have matter, the stress energy tensor of matter, which we know should be quantum. So this, in the semi-classical theory, we just make this an expectation value. And I think it's, such an equation, even if we're just treating it effectively when the fluctuations are small to understand inflation or black holes, is pathological. So the standard argument about why such a theory is pathological is that if I have a planet, say, that's on the left, I flip a coin, and if I get heads, I put a planet on the left. If it's tails, I put a planet on the right. And if we look at the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor, then that looks like half a planet on the left and half a planet on the right. Yes?
There's nothing pathological about it. It just says that it applies to situations in which you have a Gaussian state peaked on one configuration. You obviously cannot apply semi classical theory to very wide separated states like that. But so I would just put that proviso, I think there's nothing.
Yeah, I guess I might put it a bit more harshly, and I would say it applies in the cases when you don't need it. So it applies, so it's not pathological when T mu nu is very highly peaked and almost has a singular, you know, almost has just one value, in which case we can take off the triangular brackets anyway.
No, I'm just amplifying what I mean. I mean, there are cases where it is useful, like black hole evaporation, you want to know the mean flow of energy in the black hole. The
yes.
Corresponding shrinkage of the horizon.
Yeah, I mean, there's a way you.
Situations in which.
There are ways you can use it where. But I don't want to get too much into the discussion. I would say the ways that are where it's used are usually people are adding in additional information. They're not just using it straight up, or they're interpreting it in a way which is okay.
I mean, there's no doubt it's not a consistent.
That's right.
There can be situations in which I think it is true to a good approximation.
Okay.
I think there is doubt that it's not a consistent theory.
And some
corners.
Okay. So just for those that are not in gravity and coming from the quantum information, and just to go over this argument a bit more, if we take the expectation value of the planet being 50% chance on the left and 50% chance on the right, then we take the excitation value, so it's half on the left, half on the right, half a planet on the left, half a planet on the right. If we drop a test particle, then it will just go down the middle because it thinks there's two planets there. And actually, these two planets will gravitate towards each other in the semi-classical theory. So we know that's not what ought to happen. We know that this particle should either go there. And although this is an argument, so people have known this for a long time, that this means that the semi-classical theory, you should not use it. I'll make the weaker statement. There are many circumstances where you should not use it. People tend to interpret it as a reason you should not, that you must quantize gravity. It's generally interpreted as a reason why we should quantize gravity. What I want to say is that this argument is a strange one, because even in a, so of course the theory I'm going to present is not going to suffer from this issue. It will be a consistent way that you can look at the semi-classical limit of quantum gravity. If you think about it for a bit, you see that even if I have a fully quantum system, if I trace out one of the degrees of freedom, I take the expectation value, I will always have this pathological behavior. So for example, if I have an AB system, so a bipartite quantum system in this case, AB, I imagine a coupling Hamiltonian which includes, which goes like something like this. If I now ask, how does the A system behave, and I use the Heisenberg equation, so I treat everything quantumly, then what I will find, so I just, you know, die rho A, die T, I can just say that we'll take the trace of it, so minus I H A tensor H rho A B. So this is how we're tracing over B. So that's, you can use the Heisenberg equation of motion to see how the A system will behave if it's coupled to a B system, just like in the gravity case here. And what we find is that we also have a coupling to an expectation value. So we will find something which looks like this. H A, rho A, and then here we have the expectation value of H. So if we have a fully quantum system where we've quantized both degrees of freedom, then we see that if we trace out and take the expectation value of the second system, then it looks like the first system is coupling to the expectation value of the Hamiltonians. So if, for example, I flip a coin and choose the B system to be in a state with very high energy, and with a 50% chance, I prepare the system B to have one with zero energy, then again, this equation looks like the A system is coupling to the 50-50 mixture, so it's going to go straight down the center. But of course, we know that if we don't trace out the B system and examine everything that's happening, then we will see that the A system gets correlated with the B system. So just like in here, if we have a linear set of equations, what we expect to happen is that the test particle will either go to the left or to the right. If we take the expectation value of those dynamics, then indeed, the expectation value of the test particle will go down the middle. But that's because we've forgotten about the correlation. Okay? So the take-home message of this is just that, yes, we should be careful, or maybe not use the semi-classical Einstein's equation if we have large fluctuations. But that bears nothing, that has nothing to do about whether we quantize the gravitational field. All it tells you is that you should not take the semi-classical Einstein's equation seriously. Is that clear?
Yeah.
you should not misapply them where they don't apply. It's an approximation. That's right.
Yeah, but I guess what I would say is it's usually, so there's two things which are different. One is you should be very careful using, you should only use it if you have almost no fluctuations. And the second thing is it's not an argument against quantizing the gravitational field. Or sorry, against treating the gravitational field classically. And it's usually taken as such.
I would disagree with that, but please go on.
So you would disagree that you say it does.
I would say it's an approximation to a quantum theory, and that we're on a firm footing in electromagnetism, where there is a semi-classicality. You do get information from the semi-classicality, and where in order to go beyond that, you need to quantize the electromagnetic field. But I understand you have a different point of view, so
okay.
You should present your point.
Okay. The main thing is I just want to say is that it doesn't tell you that you should quantize the gravity, which I don't think is your point. But
just this equation is just a challenge. It's like if you think that gravity is classical, then what is the equation you write?
That's right. That's exactly.
It's like it would be better if you write your equation.
Okay. Good.
We know this.
Good. Okay.
There is a historical. Is it true? I kind of remember. I think Rosenfeld was a big advocate of not quantizing gravitation. He might have actually proposed this.
Yes.
So in that historical sense,
that's right.
This is an argument for quantizing. In other words, it shoots down a
yes,
serious proposal for how it's.
You're exactly right. So it was put forward as a proposal for a way to treat the gravitational field fundamentally classically. And I think that's historically why it's treated as a reason not to, that we must quantize the gravitational field. But if you look at work by Stephen Carlip or Bill Unruh about why we should quantize gravity, these sorts of arguments are mustered. So I just want to.
So what is your equation?
Good. OK. So let me start with something that's not my equation. But but it dates back to people like Blanchard and Jaddick and. So there's recently by David Poulin who showed that in with some assumptions it's the most general form of classical quantum dynamics. So let's just ask what we should demand. So we're going to ask about classical quantum, what kind of classical quantum dynamics we can have. So let me first write down the object that is a classical quantum object. So I'm going to use psi to represent a mixed state, so a density matrix in a Hilbert space. Okay, sorry, but
not rho.
Not rho, because rho often is a density matrix, is a classical density matrix. I'm getting a lot of flack for this, but I'm going to stick with it at least for now.
Maybe capital psi.
And we have a density matrix, a Hilbert space over each point in phase space. So let me just have it Q and a P. So we have phase space, and at each point in phase space, we have a density matrix. Okay. If you.
There are tensor product systems for each point in space.
Yeah, exactly. So if you wanted to write it as a CQ state, so for the quantum information people, it may be useful to think of like a Q and a P. So some Q, some P, and then some quantum state, sigma Q.
But then they're in the product form already. That's the assumption.
Yeah. Well, not a product form, because now I can integrate it. Separable. Yeah. So I have a quantum state at each point in phase space. So that's a classical quantum object. Anyone have a question about what a CQ state is?
Yeah, I don't understand what is it.
This thing or this thing?
Either.
PQ is the phase space of the field and the particle.
Sorry?
PQ is the phase space of the field and the particle.
We could imagine, so the simplest example we can imagine is a point particle, a classical particle. So a classical particle which just has a Q and a P. And imagine that it has a spin. So you have the position and momentum of the particle, Q and P, and the spin of the particle represented by the density matrix.
And where does the quantum is, like the sigma Q P?
Here. So this would be, for example, the spin. So this is the spin. So this is the density matrix, for example, of the spin of the particle. This is a quantum way of representing the position of the particle, and this is a quantum way of representing the momentum of the particle. Notice that if I want to represent this thing quantumly, I need a separate Hilbert space for the position and a separate Hilbert space for the momentum, and that's because for a classical system, I can measure both things to arbitrary accuracy. I don't have an uncertainty principle that tells me I can't. So if I were to write it as a fully quantum object, I don't like doing this because, you know, what's the relationship between Q and P? I then have to put some additional structure on it. So I prefer just to write it like this, where I have a classical phase space, and then I just put the quantum at each, you have a fiber over phase space. At each point in phase space, I have a density matrix. Question?
Yeah,
this did not go as planned. Okay, so I will get the equation.
Yeah.
So I have a valid consistent dynamics if I keep a CQ state stays a CQ state during the dynamics, and the dynamics is completely positive and trace preserving. So this at each point in phase space, this density matrix is positive, and we have a unit trace if I integrate over phase space. So I'll write down the equation. So a kind of a generic equation let me write first a generic equation, which is kind of abstract and doesn't give a particular kind of dynamics. We have a Hamiltonian, so we have we have purely quantum dynamics. So H could depend on, is a quantum Hamiltonian, but could have phase space variables. Yeah? Okay, then I can have a Poisson bracket. I forget if it's plus or minus, but it's like that. Again, we'll put a Q and P here. So this is the Poisson bracket with respect to Q and P. And now I have, I'm gonna sneak to the right side of the board. I have kind of, it'll look like a Lindblad equation for those that are familiar with Lindblad equations, but it will also have a coupling which couples the classical degrees of freedom. So we're gonna have a coupling which looks like this, and it's going to have Q, P conditioned Q prime, P prime. Sorry, here we're going to have an integral. I've used my board very poorly. L alpha. And this is an integral over phase space, dq prime. Sorry. I'm used to having a bigger blackboard. Okay. So there's this term here. It's sometimes called the jump term, right? People that know Lindblad equations. So what it means is that you can think, I look at the density matrix. So here I'm looking at what contributes to the probability or the density matrix of a point at Q and P. Here I look at I look at all the other points away from Q and P, so at a Q prime, P prime. And this gives me a jump in the classical phase space. So I can have a jump from a Q prime, P prime to a Q and P. And at the same time as I'm having a jump in the classical phase space, I have a Lindblad operator which is applied to the density matrix, so that's what we sometimes call a quantum jump. So the state has a Lindblad operator applied to it, and then you need to add, you need to, so, and this thing needs to be positive so that the state stays a density matrix. And finally, I need to conserve probability, so I have to add a final term which looks like this, minus 1/2 omega, Q, P, and then an anti-commutator. Sorry, this is the anti-commutator, this is a Poisson bracket, so let's put a PB under here to distinguish it. And then where W and W at Q and P is defined as the integral so this condition arises just in order to conserve probability Q P see that? Okay, so that's the equation there. Daniel?
So in the first two terms, is that the same H, or is there some H quantum and H classical?
You could have an H quantum, you could have an H classical, but this here is going to, I'm going to make this to be the same H, and I could also imagine that these Ls, they can be any operators, so they could, for example, include the identity, and if you have them the identity, then that starts to look like a stochastic version of the Poisson bracket. So you can move things back and forth. That's just a, that's what I've written here is a convenient way to write it, where I've taken H to be the same operator.
But I mean, it's something that mixes classical.
Yeah, yes. Okay. Sorry, you're right. So let's take this one here in this writing. Let's take this one to be a purely classical thing here. So let's call it H zero. I think it'll be clearer.
You could add them together in the first group.
Yeah, there's an ambiguity in how you, so for when you want to make your theory Lorentz invariant and later diffeomorphism invariant, you have very little choice over how you split it up. But for just the abstract case, it's fairly arbitrary. Yes?
Now I have the question. So you call this a classical theory. So first of all, is it correct that we should interpret the square of psi and Q and P as somehow the probability of the particle being at Q and P? Is that
Yeah, so psi here is subnormalized. Yeah, so
equation.
Psi here is subnormalized. So what we would, you know, what we want is that if we take the trace, so if we take the trace of psi and then integrate it over Q and P, so this thing has to equal one. Okay, so that's.
Okay, so the second half of that question, I said it's a square because I'm reading it as a wave function.
Right.
Of course.
Yeah, it's a density matrix, so.
It's a density matrix.
Yeah.
But the second part of that question, is it part of this? That the classical particle actually has a trajectory.
It has a trajectory.
Or the probability distribution at each moment of time.
Well,
if it has a trajectory, then what's the equation of motion? What governs the trajectory?
Right. So the equations of motion, this is what governs the trajectory. So this gives a probability. So you can interpret this as there's a probability per unit time that the imagine, I think it's easier to imagine that it's at a particular point in phase space. So it's at a particular point, let's call it Q prime, P prime. And then there's a probability per unit time that it jumps in phase space to Q and P, to be at Q and P. And when it does that jump in phase space, it also does a jump in Hilbert space in that the Lindblad operators are applied on the left and right. And for at least the non-relativistic version, I think it's easier to think of it as being at a particular point in space. So you can monitor where it is in classical phase space. You know always where it is at a particular QNP, and you can see it move. And conditioned on where it is, the quantum state will be in a pure state, actually. There's people with their hands in their hands. Yes.
So you need to impose some conditions on the W so that you have the continuous.
Yes. So W has to be positive. It has to be a positive. It's a matrix, I guess, in QNP space. And so it has to be a positive matrix in alpha beta. And this is the normalization condition, which guarantees that it'd be trace preserving in this sense, so conserved probability.
And if you impose those conditions, you continue to have this kind of semi.
That's right. Exactly. So if you impose, those are the only conditions you need. And if you have those conditions, then it's preserves probability, keeps positive things positive, what probabilities need to be positive, and have to sum to one. Yes. Good. Okay. Let me first just take any questions. I'm not too bothered how far we. What would you like to see?
Where gravity.
Gravity. Good. Okay. Gravity. So this is a general form of the equation. It's been known before. And now what we need is we need a way that this W should encode the I'll show that we can encode any Hamiltonian we want. And in particular, we can take the ADM Hamiltonian. Yeah. So I don't know how far if I'll get to gravity, but let me just first show you. What we want. We want that W, if we perform a Taylor expansion on W, or something called a Kramer's Moyal expansion, we want that W, that its zeroth moment just gives us decoherence, and we want that its first moment looks like the action of a Hamiltonian. And once we have the action of a Hamiltonian, we can put in the ADM Hamiltonian of general relativity. Okay?
So maybe for the Q and P in the case of gravity,
so we'll do the so Q and P for gravity are going to be we're going to do the ADM split. So Q and P are going to be the free metric at each point in space, and the conjugate momentum. So we're going to have at each point in space we have a phase space. So the phase space of general relativity is just the space of all three metrics and their conjugate moment.
And W is like a propagator? What does it mean to satisfy which equation?
Yeah, so W can be, as I said, purely abstract in that it can just be it will be a propagator. I can write it. So what it will look like for arbitrary, so a choice, a realization of this for, say, any Q and P is going to look something like this. So one example is something like this, where we take a Hamiltonian here, a classical Hamiltonian, and we take the Poisson brackets and this axon phi of Q. So this would be W. So this here is how W acts on the wave function. Okay? So you can see that if we Taylor expand this, then at first order, we get the Poisson bracket. It looks like the Poisson brackets of classical mechanics. So if we look at the first order term of this thing.
Sorry, so what are is it W together with the L?
Yes.
Yeah, so let me write. So what we want is we're going to have something that looks like this. We have a W. I'm going to use Z for phase space here. Z prime L alpha psi z prime, so z prime is just phase space, l beta. So we're going to replace this, and this is an integral over dz prime. it's going to be a functional integral in the case of GR when we have a classical field. And so this will look something like e to the tau h, some classical Hamiltonian, and then we're going to have it acting on L alpha psi q and p. So this is the jump term.
What are the labels that from beta?
Sorry?
What are the labels that from beta? Do the everything depend on it?
Yeah, so it turns out that what you...
It's an H alpha beta?
H alpha beta? Yeah. Oh, sorry, good. Yes. Thank you. So the way, what we do is we take any Hamiltonian, a classical quantum Hamiltonian, and we're going to write it out as a sum over alpha beta, H alpha beta, L beta dagger, L alpha. Okay, so this is what I would call a classical quantum Hamiltonian. The classical degrees of freedom are contained in this H. The quantum degrees of freedom are these operators here. You can see that when we trace out this thing, we get...
Are you summing over?
Sorry?
What are the labels? The
summing over alpha beta.
Where are, is it the P, the Q, the... What are the labels?
This is just a basis, right? A basis, any basis of operators. So let me give you the one for field theory.
Yes.
So a scalar field in GR, we might have something that looks, these would just be the field operators. So we might have something which looks like, so our Hamiltonian, can be something like phi squared. So this is an L alpha and an L beta. And then the metric term is going to be here. So this looks like the root g here is my h phi phi. Okay? And then I have the pi squared. And then this thing here is my h pi pi. So what I'm doing is and then you have the del phi. So I'm taking my... So what you're doing is you take your Hamiltonian, you have the gravitational degrees of freedom here, here you have your quantum degrees of freedom, which are the operators, which are your Lindblad operators, here you have your gravitational degrees of freedom, which are just the metric, free metric, and so that becomes the metric which induces the movement in phase space, in this case.
So alpha is an infinite dimensional space that contains all the x's and all the possible fields on top of the x's.
That's right.
So it's a double functional integral.
Yeah, so when we would actually write this, it would be a functional integral over the g mu nu, both over x and over g and pi.
And their derivative.
Sorry?
And their derivative.
Right, and in fact, an infinite sum of an infinitely many derivatives, because if you truncate this Taylor, so if you truncate this to first order, then you just get the, the Liouville equation of classical general relativity. Okay, so usually we don't think of general, we just, you can have it, you can imagine that you treat general relativity as a Liouville equation, where you have a density in phase space. If we were to truncate this to first order, we would get the Liouville equation of general relativity. But in fact, you cannot truncate. You need to go to all orders in order to keep the density matrix positive. If you truncate, then you get negative probabilities. So you need to take this to all orders. And what I think that means is that the jumps in the classical phase space are actually jumps. They're discrete and finite size jumps.
Since we don't manage to go anywhere, I think my main concern is covariance.
Yes.
And because you also speak about lunch, jumps, which I guess refer to something in time, if you have a time parameter.
Yes.
I guess it refers more to the dynamics of the scalar field than gravity, but I'm maybe so far it's not obvious at all that it can become a covariance in the sense that.
You mean diffeomorphism invariance?
GR plus the scalar field would be a totally constrained system.
Persistent.
A completely constrained system.
Yes, that's right.
Meaning that you wouldn't have such a, you don't have a wave equation. If you would quantize it, the wave equation would not come as a Schrödinger equation, but as a Wheeler equation.
That's right. So what? So for this, you can. This is how you would get the dynamical equation of GR. You then have the constraint equations, and those you can impose as well in a very similar form. So rather than imposing them as operator, as a equation on the operator, so that, for example, that the super Hamiltonian is zero, you impose it on the equations of motion. So you demand diffeomorphism invariance of the equations of motion, and you get an equation, I can write it down, but you get a CQ equation, which the right-hand side equals zero. So I'll get some equation which looks something like, forget this, but just has a bunch of terms like this equals zero, where the generator of those dynamics is the, so if I take the Hamiltonian of GR, I can write it out as the Hamiltonian part and the super momentum part. And then I can write, so I've got a way here to generate any CQ dynamics given a decomposition of the Hamiltonian. And now I will take the super Hamiltonian and the super momentum and generate the dynamics of that. And that gives me the constraints, the super Hamiltonian and the super momentum.
So is there a way to jump to some other ways your generalization of GU with the expectation
of GU? So the
constraints.
Right. So the what you actually get, if I want to take the classical limit, what I'll get is something like I take this over G here, and now let's take the trace of this thing. So that will give us the expectation value. And the first order term is going to look like something like trace psi H ADM here. So you'll get something which looks like this. Okay. So that, this is what I said, that the classical limit of this theory is the Liouville equation rather than the Einstein equation. And whether or not you believe that fundamentally gravity is classical, this at least provides a consistent way to think about large fluctuations of the quantum system and of the gravitational field and looking at the back direction. So at the very least, this is a consistent way to take the semi-classical limit of gravity. And maybe for people that don't believe this classical gravity story, that might be the kind of more interesting thing. The organizer is standing up, which he doesn't have the hockey stick yet, but I'll
thank you, Nanda.
I'll end here. Yeah. So thanks very much for your attention.
More questions?
Well, if I did this point of semi-classical limit, what would be your analysis of T and U? Like, is there a covariant version?
Yeah, so here, I mean, here's the ADM. It's done in the ADM formulation. So from there, you can go to the full Einstein equation. But I've thought about it in the 3 plus 1 split.
But still, the quantum theory, the constraints they do, and the quantum theory,
yes.
The constraints they do actually two things. Which is they work as constraint equations.
Yes.
But also they impose each and one else.
Yes.
Whereas classically, you have to do that separately.
You could,
so if you classify quantum gravity, wouldn't there be also the need for a second step?
Yeah. So, so this is something I don't know, I've not seen, I'd be interested if anyone has seen this before, which is on the classical theory, rather than imposing gauge by saying, picking H equals zero, I could also impose it on the levels of the equation of motion. So I could say, I'm going to demand that rho h equals zero. Okay? That's another way, purely classical theory, of imposing the Hamiltonian constraint.
Yeah, there was rho is some density matrix.
Rho is now the density matrix of the classical theory. Yeah, I mean, like a phase space density.
It's a phase space density.
Yeah.
So this would impose causal gauge invariance of rho.
Well, of the equations of motion. It's telling you the equations of motion.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes?
But you would still have to impose the initial values, as if it's just h equals to zero.
Well, this is, think of this as being the classical Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So people usually associate the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and the problem of time as a quantum problem. It's a purely, but you can think of it as a purely classical problem. I can impose the constraint like this. This looks like a Wheeler-DeWitt equation, but it's purely classical. I say that this is solved by density matrix, which commute with H.
I see that I was imposing that because H is generating H confirmation. So I see that as a requirement that O is actually H in my functional.
That's right, or that I reduce to the phase space where rho is only defined on the phase space for which this holds. So it's a reduced, it's a direct kind of.
There's two different things. So the H equal to zero is really, it's a condition which gives you some only forward of phase space.
That's right.
This condition tells you that function rho is constant along the orbits of H.
That's right.
These are two different
concepts. I agree. So
to be enforced.
Well, one is like the direct quantization, and one is like the reduced phase space. They're equivalent. And one finds something interesting. If you demand this, and then demand that the algebra closes, then you get an additional tertiary constraint, which you don't get if you impose it by just saying h equals zero, and that projects you down to the standard phase space.
It gets back to the question about trajectory. So, I mean, if gravity and therefore space-time also is really classical,
yes,
then we have to ask what kind of trajectory, what kind of space-times are we talking about in this series? It's very hard for me to see how these jumps can be reconciled with some form of general covariance or diffeomorphism invariance, because if these jumps are by finite amounts, they're taking place across some hypersurface, which is the hypersurface on which this, I mean, maybe what I'm saying is not true. This is how I'm getting myself confused. So somebody, if there's something wrong in what I'm saying.
You want to ask
whether you can draw pictures of that? No, I don't want to ask this. I want to ask, that seems to pick out a distinguished slicing, because either that or you have a totally discontinuous field across all hypersurfaces. You see what I'm saying? So,
yes.
Can you give us one candidate space-time that could be a solution? It's true that it's stochastically chosen solution, but can you tell us one?
It's not a space-time, it's not going to be a space-time that's a solution. You need to solve the constraint equation. It's going to be it's going to be a rho which is a solution. So it'll be a mixed state, a classical mixed state which solves the constraint. So the different pieces might be moving in some strange way, but the actual phase space, if I think of it as a density over those manifolds, that will be stationary. That will satisfy the constraint.
But if we go back to your other case, the first one that you talked about, the mixed classical quantum, I asked you if there was a trajectory for the target. And you said there was a stochastic trajectory.
Yes.
So is the end, are you saying now in the gravity case, it's not like that?
No.
There's no more trajectory for this.
Well, there's a trajectory in phase space, and there's
Is there a trajectory in phase space, depending on some external time, or depending on some choice of labs?
Right, so you want that it's...
That's the nature of the...
Right, so you want it that it's independent of the slicing...
I'd like to know what it could look like.
I think, to say that, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the individual trajectories with the jumps are invariant, but that the distribution...
Yes.
But I'd just like to know what one of them looks like.
I have no idea. I mean, it's a difficult equation to solve. I don't... I don't pretend. So I can show you some toy models. So I can give you some toy models, not now, but I'm happily afterwards. I can give you some toy models where you can see what happens in some toy models where you have some constraints. So I can give you a constraint system where I can solve it. But for GR, I don't know. But there are some equations, and you can attempt to solve them on a computer. But they're not easy to see. They're not easy to solve.
But what Daniel said, you agreed to what Daniel said, so.
Right.
So that means in any real case, like in our world, there is actually some highly distinguished slicing of the space-time.
Maybe you can discuss that afterwards. Let us just close the session here. Thank Jonathan again. You're here for the rest of the day, so people may still come to you with more questions. So.
Sure.
Thanks again.
Thank you.